From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
The recriminations continue. Why did Florida Democrats do so badly in the last election?
The campaign didn't break through well enough to those independents to get them to believe us that Kamala Harris was the solution to the problems that they were facing.
Also this week, could Florida reinstate a controversial wild bear hunt? Advocates believe there's little other choice.
If we're going to have a natural distribution of wildlife, it is important that we use man in the picture.
We'll also visit the Apalachicola River Basin and Bay to get an update about the beleaguered oyster industry, as well as what could be a new environmental threat to the region. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. The November election was more than a month ago, but the finger-pointing and accusation trading among Democrats continues. Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried visited Derek Ham's Deeper Dive podcast to do a post-mortem on the election results. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
If you could do everything over, what would you do differently at the state level? And what do you think maybe should have been done differently at the national level?
At the state level, you know, we are rebuilding. And so year-round organizing has to happen.
Do you think the expectations were too high? People saying Florida is in play. Jamie Harrison, did that help? Because he would come and say that, and I had him on the show even, and I'm like, really?
Look, we felt it. And I would not say it.
There was an enthusiasm.
We felt it. Yeah. We felt it going off.
It was palpable.
It was. We had 150,000 new volunteers signing up in Florida.
It was a thing.
We had people at Canvas launches that have never been there before. We had people coming to Democratic events that were Republicans. We had independents. The last 18 months, 60-70% were with us. We were turning out our Democrats. Independents were breaking for us. We were getting Republicans. That is a formulation for winning. Unfortunately, the campaign didn't break through well enough to those independents to get them to believe us that Kamala Harris was the solution to the problems that they were facing.
Okay, but that's the presidential race.
Right.
And your role as the state leader, is there anything that you would have done differently or any lessons that you've learned that you're going to apply moving forward?
Yeah, realistically 2024, we got to an organizing apparatus that was efficient. And so to be able to carry that on, we weren't ready in 2023. We started to do the groundwork of really developing the DECs and recruiting of the candidates and starting some of that work. We needed to raise the alarm a lot faster with real serious dollars talking to us about how to do voter registration. Partisan voter registration is the key to getting us out of this conversation. But unfortunately, we have seen cycle after cycle, a lot of those resources going to nonpartisan organizations. That's why we have almost a third of our state as independent at this point. So that money has to come in-house. And while we were making those arguments in 2023, and we were putting whatever resources that we were getting on the ground, we tried a lot of different things and they didn't work. And so now we got to go back, come up with a real plan on how to crack this nut of voter registration and get the significant fundraising dollars that we're going to need. And the Democratic donors that I've been talking to, including Hillary Clinton, when I spoke to her a couple weeks ago, want Florida back in play for presidentials. And they recognize, and they have to recognize, that they've got to come in and work on voter registration with us.
That was Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried speaking on the Deeper Dive with Derek Ham podcast from the News Service of Florida. You can download it from wherever you get your podcasts. Florida wildlife officials are considering a plan that could lead to the state's first bear hunt in nearly a decade. Regan McCarthy reports the last time the state okayed such a hunt, more than 300 black bears were called in the span of about 2 days.
The idea of a bear hunt is a controversial one. During a recent meeting on the issue, about 20 members of the public addressed the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, speaking on both sides of the issue. Kate McFall is Florida Director of the Humane Society of the United States. She was among the people who spoke.
The Humane Society of the United States and the humane community, we oppose trophy hunting. Certainly, we oppose black bear hunting and respectfully urge you not to consider such a hunt.
One of the factors at play is growing concern over human-bear interactions. Earlier this year, lawmakers approved a law that lets people kill bears without penalty if they feel the bear is threatening their home, property, pets, or family. The measure was supported by Franklin County Sheriff A.J. Smith, who told lawmakers his deputies frequently receive calls for help with bears. But McFall says there are other ways to keep bears out of neighborhoods, like using bear-proof trash cans.
Because regardless of the number of bears in the woods, if you have a track that's in the neighborhood, y'all know this, there will be bears and other wildlife.
Newton Cook with United Waterfowlers of Florida says he thinks sometimes it makes sense for humans to step in.
Over the eons, man has hunted bears, and occasionally a bear has hunted a man. And if we're going to have a natural distribution of wildlife, it is important that we use man in the picture.
Wildlife officials have directed their staff to compile data and study the possible impact of another bear hunt in the state, with a presentation due to the commission in May. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Well, depending on where they're going and what the weather conditions might be, there could be a lot of dashing through the snow when it comes to Florida travelers over the upcoming holidays. A record 7.1 million Floridians are expected to travel more than 50 miles over the end-of-year holiday period. That's an increase of more than 3% since last Christmas. About 90% of those traveling will be driving to their destinations, but record air travel is also expected. The busiest day on the roads this year should be Sunday, December 22nd, according to all projections. AAA spokesman Mark Jenkins said four of the top five domestic travel destinations this holiday season are in the Sunshine State, so Floridians should be prepared for crowded roads and airports.
With a record number of people traveling, you should just expect more congestion wherever you're going, especially in some of the larger metro areas and near the popular attractions. Just leave early if you can.
Nationally, Orlando is the most popular place to vacation over the holidays this year. The holiday travel period is considered as December 21st through New Year's Day. Coming up on Capitol Report, with the year-end holidays looming, Florida lawmakers made a quick trip to Tallahassee this week. One big agenda item, the complex and often convoluted behavioral expectations for lawmakers.
Some of them are fairly obvious, but others of them can be more tricky. They can be more nuanced.
A judge considers a request to allow exploratory fossil fuel drilling in an environmentally sensitive North Florida river basin. Opponents fear what a yes decision might mean.
And it would be devastation for everything downriver and into our precious bay.
Meanwhile, an award-winning documentary on the destruction of Apalachicola's famous oyster beds will soon have a much wider audience.
The things have all declined as the coastline has been developed, as the Apalachicola Flint Chattahoochee River has been dammed up in a lot of cases.
And it seems despite all the medical advancements, HIV and AIDS remains a widespread public health issue.
Florida led the U.S. in the number of HIV cases and had, you know, the third highest new infection rate.
Florida legislators were back at the Capitol this week for several trainings and presentations ahead of next year's session. Tristan Wood reports that included economics and ethics workshops.
State senators received a presentation from Amy Baker, coordinator for Florida's Office of Economic and Demographic Research. She says Florida's GDP is high and has been high since the COVID-19 pandemic, but her office expects it to decrease over the coming years to return to pre-pandemic levels.
The assumptions we made this summer are behaving pretty much like we thought we would. We're still slightly higher than the nation's growth in GDP. We're at 3.2. The nation as a whole is at 3%, but that 3.2 is much closer to the nation as a whole than what we had when we first met in September.
Baker also pointed out Florida has seen significant population growth in the last 10 years. Orange County had the most growth, with over 272,000 people moving there since 2014. However, However, her department's research suspects that level of population and economic growth won't continue as quickly after the year 2030. That's largely because baby boomers are aging, and younger demographics do not have as strong a desire generally to retire in Florida. And she says the boomers who have moved here could start costing the state more money.
Is by the time you hit 85, you start having more and more challenges, whether it's with mobility, driving, healthcare issues, so a variety of challenges. So while we've, as a state, totally benefited through now and probably through 2030 from the baby boomers moving into Florida, as they age in place, they're going to become a more expensive population for us.
Senators also received 4 hours of ethics presentations over the course of 2 days. Gray Schaefer is the senior attorney for the Florida Commission on Ethics. He says it's important for lawmakers to have a good grasp of the rules.
Some of them are fairly obvious, but others of them can be more tricky. They can be more nuanced. They can be violated in ways that might not always seem obvious. But that's where the State Ethics Commission comes into play. We are there to help you.
The commission oversees ethics complaints about state employees and elected officials. Schaefer says the most common complaint last year was for misuse of position, with 51 complaints coming in on that issue.
It prohibits a public officer from corruptly using their position to get an improper benefit for themselves or for someone else. It corruptly means to intentionally act in a manner inconsistent with the proper performance of your public duties to obtain that benefit.
Schaefer says the commission would rather people under their jurisdiction come to them with ethics questions when they have doubts. He says sometimes people are concerned asking questions will start an investigation into them, but that isn't true.
We don't have any authority currently to self-initiate an ethics matter. So there's no downside then to contacting us. We'll respond using one of these opinion methods, and our goal will be to get you a quick answer to your question.
While the legislative session doesn't start until March, expect lawmakers to be up in Tallahassee more starting in January for committee weeks and other events. I'm Tristan Wood.
An administrative law judge is considering allowing a permit to drill for oil in northwest Florida's Apalachicola River Basin. The site being considered is in rural Calhoun County in the River Basin's floodplain, and the State Department of Environmental Protection supports the idea. But the basin is highly fragile. In the past, its struggles for survival have upended the economy of Franklin County and reached the U.S. Supreme Court. More on the story now from Margie Menzel.
The rest of the state and nation may have forgotten about the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. But they haven't on the so-called Forgotten Coast, in places like Apalachicola and St. George Island that depend on seafood and tourism.
Our livelihoods depend on clean water. And we know, we all know, that oil and water do not mix. We know that one accident, one spill, one flood event, and it would be devastation for everything downriver and into our precious bay.
That's Soshi Bervera of Water is Life Oysters, speaking on the steps of the Department of Environmental Protection's headquarters in Tallahassee. She was surrounded by people holding signs reading, "Kill the Drill."
We've seen it before. The people of the Gulf Coast know what can happen when you have accidents with oil.
Naturalist Jack Rudlow of the Gulf Specimen Marine Laboratory was there, too, holding a large stuffed fish.
The oysters have crashed. The shrimp have gone to hell. The populations of marine life since the oil spill with Deepwater Horizon has been a disaster.
David Damon, the owner of J.P. Roberts Hurricane Shutters, reminded the crowd of what happened to local small businesses after the spill.
Many businesses went under. Many businesses had to take out loans that they're still paying back today, these many years later. We survived it because we've been around a long time and we were able to, but many couldn't. hundreds and hundreds of jobs depend on these businesses along the coast.
A Louisiana-based company, Clearwater Land and Mineral LLC, applied for the permit roughly a year ago, and in April, DEP announced that they planned to grant it. The permit was then challenged by Apalachicola Riverkeeper, a citizen group that contends the failure rate of wells drilled in Calhoun County and its neighbors is 100%, 70 dry holes out of 70 wells drilled. Looming over the conflict is the shadow of further damage to the Apalachicola River Basin, which used to provide 90% of Florida's oysters and 10% of the nation's. But the bay is now being rehabilitated. It fell victim to the state's so-called water wars with Georgia and Alabama, in which fresh water to Florida's north was depleted before it crossed the state line. And after the Deepwater Horizon spill, people were worried the oil would go into the bay and damage the oysters, so they harvested too many too young. The bay collapsed in 2012. State Senator Corey Simon, who represents the area, has fought to fund efforts to repopulate the bay with oysters. He opposes the drilling permit, calling the idea unconscionable.
I think the folks that are looking to do this, the folks over at Clearwater Land and Mineral, they need to understand the impact. They need to understand that families are struggling in these areas. Both of these counties are fiscally constrained counties. And so we can't have anything at this point that is going to hurt their ability to come back and feed their families.
The hole would be drilled in Calhoun County, northern neighbor of Franklin County. Calhoun lost its thriving timber industry to Hurricane Michael and supports the plan to drill. A DEP spokeswoman said the agency couldn't comment while the case is being heard. Calhoun County commissioners wouldn't comment either. But students from Cornerstone Learning Community wrote speeches and delivered them on the DEP steps.
It threatens our drinking water. If we drill down to the aquifer, it could contaminate the drinking water for several counties in this region and destroy the cleanest water in the country.
Appalachia is very much a fishing and oyster town, and if the fish die and the oysters disappear, the town will also, 193 years of community washed away.
And I love to swim, and I can't swim in oil. Oh, so what about us? What about my generation? We want a beautiful river too. So do your kids and your kids' kids.
Those voices belong to Wyatt Simpson, Penny Hutchinson, and Taylor Weebler. According to Apalachicola Riverkeeper Executive Director Susan Anderson, it could take 2 to 6 months for Judge Lawrence Stevenson to decide whether to allow the drilling permit to go forward. I'm Margie Menzel.
The slow-rolling disaster that has devastated what was the source of America's most celebrated oysters will soon be known across the country. The story in all its tragic complexity was captured on film by director Josh McLawhorn and entitled Unfiltered, The Truth About Oysters.
In late 2018, when the producer of the film, Chucha Barber, approached me about directing this film and creating it with her, we thought it was going to be maybe a 30-minute TV program. And, you know, as we got into it, we realized that the story was so much larger than we could effectively tell in, you know, the 24 minutes of a half-hour TV program.
Unfiltered became a full-blown documentary. It was screened at more than 30 film festivals worldwide. It won 11 awards, including Best Documentary, both at home and abroad. It garnered a Suncoast Regional Emmy Award. And on January 15th, it will make its broadcast premiere on every PBS station in Florida. PBS will also make it available on its streaming platform.
Having the film go national and be available for on-demand streaming through PBS Passport is really, honestly, a surreal feeling for me.
But then the whole tale of how a once vibrant, prosperous seafood resort should essentially dry up in less than a generation has its own elements of surrealism.
It was this very healthy, relatively untouched natural environment that created this very healthy estuary where you could harvest mullet and oysters and shrimp and, you know, all kinds of fish. And you saw, you know, large pelagic game fish and everything like that. Those things have all declined as the coastline has been developed, as the Apalachicola, Flint, Chattahoochee River has been dammed up in a lot of cases, and a lot of that water is being siphoned off for other things that might be seen as more economically productive.
And because the near demise of the Gulf Coast's wild oyster beds has also stirred political accusations and cultural resentments, McLawhorn wanted the story to be presented with virtually no editorial bias. So it's a story that literally tells itself with no narration.
We didn't want to put our spin as filmmakers on it. We didn't want you to get Josh and Chucha's opinion. We wanted you to hear the words straight from these people who are involved in the issue in one way or another, whether they're, you know, commercial seafood workers, whether they're aquaculture business owners.
There is a good reason, he says, why the situation has long been called another war between the states, as Florida, Georgia, and Alabama feud over the water that flows southward towards the Gulf and the oyster beds that depend upon that water for their existence.
More often than not, you'll get sort of a gut reaction from people, and they'll say something about Georgia or Atlanta. Atlanta's got all the water. And that is absolutely part of the issue. And it's a part of the issue that continues to get worse all the time. But it's definitely not the only factor that caused Apalachicola Bay to collapse.
To further complicate an already complex tale, the state of Florida will decide in 2025 whether to end its 5-year ban on wild oyster harvesting. Even here, McLawhorn doesn't want to take sides, although he hopes the final decision will be guided by all the Bay health data that's been gathered by Florida State University.
I think it should only be reopened if the population is healthy enough to sustain a wild harvest where each year as the oysters reproduce, they produce more than was taken.
McLawhorn insists there's hope for the future of the Bay and its iconic bivalves. He cites the recovery of other once ravaged water bodies like the Chesapeake Bay, and he hopes the film will also act as a cautionary tale.
This is a story that's relevant not just to our area that the story focuses on, but really every coastal community around the world, because a lot of the same pressures that have caused the decline and the collapse of Apalachicola's oyster reefs are experienced really all over the world.
Unfiltered, The Truth About Oysters airs on all Florida PBS stations January 15th and will be available for streaming on PBS Passport. We have a couple of stories on Florida wildlife. 20 critically endangered Kemp's Ridley sea turtles arrived in the Florida Keys this week. They're being treated after suffering cold stunning. They were rescued after getting trapped in the waters off Cape Cod.
Sea turtles are ectothermic. What that means is they take on the temperature of the air and the water surrounding them. Anything below 50 degrees Fahrenheit can become a mortality event for a sea turtle.
Betty Zirkelback greeted the Kemp's Ridleys as they arrived in banana boxes flown by volunteer pilots. She manages the Turtle Hospital in Marathon.
We are lucky that it's already warm here, so not only will we warm them up, but we're going to deal with all the things that happens from those cold temperatures.
And that could mean treatment for pneumonia, infections, or other ailments. Meanwhile, the Everglades in South Florida is home to one of the planet's rarest birds. That's the Cape Sable Seaside Sparrow. Restoration work could jeopardize some of its nesting habitat, so WLRN's Jenny Stiletovich tells us there's a plan to help save the bird.
For years, wildlife managers have wrestled with how to save the sparrow, while restoration managers struggle to move more water south to keep the Everglades from dying. Now they have a solution, captive breeding.
We can't wait and build all of this infrastructure and then be in a place where we can't move water south, because we haven't figured out how to conserve the bird.
Jennifer Reynolds is with the South Florida Water Management District. Conservationists fighting to protect the critical nesting area in the path of restoration now worry they're running out of time. They don't want to see the Cape Sable Sparrow wind up like the dusky seaside sparrow, which went extinct in the 1980s. Julie Rathmel is Executive Director of Audubon Florida.
I don't know which is sadder, the idea of the last captive male dying in captivity, the last free-flying male singing every spring without an answer, or the fact that we live with the regret today that we waited too long.
The 5-year pilot project approved this week will cost about $500,000. I'm Jenny Stiletovich in Miami.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, December is HIV and AIDS Awareness Month, and health advocates across the state and country are educating the public on the various treatment and prevention options for patients. Adrian Andrews tells us more.
Florida is home to roughly 22 million people, and according to the state's Department of Health and the Center for Disease Control, more than 128,000 Floridians are HIV positive. That's the highest of any state in the U.S. Christopher Woodring, a senior pharmacist at an HIV rehab clinic in New York, says the number of HIV patients in Florida has steadily climbed over the last 5 years.
HIV is increasing in Florida. It looks like you've almost increased from 2019 to the most recent data in 2024 by 15,000 persons living with HIV. So that was a number around 115,000, and now it looks like it's closer to 130,000.
Woodring says Florida has the third highest new infection rate in the nation, and he says the virus kills hundreds of people in Florida each year. Health officials say the spread of HIV is linked to unsafe practices, lack of awareness, and limited access to HIV care. To combat this, Florida clinics are working with the federal Ryan White HIV and AIDS program. The initiative, which came about in 1990, allows health clinics to use federal funds to pay for HIV treatment and other related services to low-income patients.
So we have case management, housing assistance, food assistance, mental health counselors, pretty much everything that a client that's HIV positive could need.
Rob Renzi is the CEO of Big Ben Cares in Tallahassee. It's part of the Ryan White program and provides care for HIV patients. Renzi says his facility also works to help people reduce their chance of contracting the virus. That's done with the help of Congress's 340B drug pricing program. Renzi says since becoming a Ryan White partner, his clinic receives their HIV medication at a discounted rate. The money saved goes towards free STD education programs.
When I first started, we got just around $1 million in Ryan White funds, and we had about 360 patients. Today, 20 years later, I have over 1,000 patients. So without 340B to supplement, we would not be able to do anything.
Health experts urge at-risk people to get tested and begin HIV PrEP medication to reduce the chances of getting HIV. Emily Blakelock, an executive officer of the National Ryan White 340B program, also notes that people who aren't at risk should do their part as well by staying informed on the latest HIV services.
We provide dental services. We provide food vouchers. We help with transportation for more rural areas to provide access. And so it's really the crux of that wraparound services that we're providing that leads to the elimination of HIV.
I'm Adrian Andrews.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Derek Hamm and Jenny Stiletovich. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.